those arms, and we cut that. I'm going to refer to having a panel of fusion cells, and then I'll look more for some pieces. So hear a little bit about what each person on the panel works on, and that might motivate you to ask for particular questions relating to your area of expertise. Let me start by introducing myself. My name is Joseph Emerson. I'm a postdoctoral fellow here. I've been at Furman for 1 year. I did a postdoc at MIT for 2 years. And before that, I did a PhD at Simon Fraser here in Canada. I'm Canadian. And we have quite a good national panel. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves, starting on the far end.
Okay, I'm Christopher Lomsberger, a postdoctoral fellow here. I just arrived. I did my first postdoc for 6 years in Los Angeles, California. So I'm working in string theory, which is kind of an attempt to explain all kinds of all physics from very small to very big, explain all particles out there and all interactions. Well, interactions include electricity and magnetism that everybody knows. Then there are the nuclear forces which hold the nucleus together, the atoms together. And then there's gravity, and we try to unify all of that. And the basic idea is that, well, matter is made of atoms, and the atoms are made out of electrons flying around the nucleus, and the nucleus is made again out of protons and neutrons, and those are again made out of quarks and gluons, and that's as far as we know what's there. And so we have a bunch of different particles that everything's made of. And in string theory, as you can see, there's excellent particles called little strings, like rubber bands, which are subatomic. And depending on how we vibrate those different particles, they interact by going in and separating the different parts. Yeah, it's kind of successful in describing all the interactions that we don't quite get exactly yet. All the particles we have. For one part, we get too many, and then we don't get some other particles out of the air, but we get pretty good choice.
By the way, how's the volume in the back?
Can you hear it?
Seems like it's a louder?
Yeah, a lot.
It's not slap.
So my name is Peter Alvier. I'm French, and I've been doing my PhD in Marseille, in South of France. And now I've been here in Chicago for 1 year as a postdoctoral fellow. So I'm working in quantum hertz, that is trying to find new physical phenomena when merging quantum mechanics and general relativity. On the one hand, we've got quantum mechanics and expansion into quantum field theory, which is our best current framework to understand particles and their interaction and how they evolve in space-time. And on the other hand, we've got general relativity, which is our theory describing the computation, but also told us that space-time is not only a static area in which matter evolves, but it's also a dynamical object itself. So, when trying to make these two theories mathematically consistent with each other, we should go point at which space-time will be conformed with itself, and then got some kind of concept of atom of space-time at the lowest microscopic scale, that is some kind of a billion, a billion, a billion, a billion of centimeters. And so my job is to try to understand what are these atoms of space-time, what they mean, and how to patch them up together, form a smooth and continuous and plastic space-time, and to see how it is.
Well, I'm Dennis Stefan. I'm
I think they must be compiling them and they prefer to work about a year and a half. Secondly, I work in marketing. Again, it's probably predicted by my origins. My dad is a communication engineer, and my mom was a physicist that turned to be a programmer. So the merge of information and physics sort of runs in families, so quantum information was probably the most appropriate subject for my grad studies. I've worked on usual quantum information, that means trying to figure out how to communicate, how to encrypt, using quantum laws of nature and using facts. Mirrors of information, physical objects that describe those quantum mechanics. And then I began to be interested, well, in more exotic phenomena, black holes or the mysterious thing that I wanted to do when I was in grade 10, and then it was sort of immature to do it when you were a physicist, but later if big guys can play these toys, me too. So most of my interest now is a combination of quantum information and relativistic physics. And here it may be, and I mean, I don't care about the model too much. I just try to see what of the stuff that I know can help in its development, get some predictions. And then we see whether these predictions are true or false. If they're true, fine, but we kick it off and move together, move forward. So what I do is just many applications in the case of information theory to front gravity and other sort of phenomena.
My name is also Daniel Bausman. I'm a long-term research researcher here at Fermat. I've been here a year and a half, 2 years. I'm from the U.S. originally. I got my PhD at Caltech, and I did postdocs at Los Alamos National Lab, Microsoft Research, and UC Berkeley. I also work on quantum computing. Danny mentioned briefly what the study of quantum information is about, but maybe I'll expand on that a little bit. Actually, a number of people mentioned quantum mechanics, so let's start with that. If you had a big object, they behave, well, classically, that's the way we're all familiar with. But very small objects behave very differently, like single atoms behave according to the rules of quantum mechanics. And so the idea of quantum computing is that if you could build a computer that took advantage of this special behavior of individual atoms, you could do some things a lot better than a regular computer could do. And so there's a lot of people trying to build quantum computers. I'm more interested in trying to figure out what they can do and what you can do with quantum information more generally, and what that tells us about quantum mechanics.
Thanks, Dan. So I won't tell the names here, just so if you want to direct your questions towards a particular researcher. Thank you. So there's a sixth person will be joining us in about 20 minutes. He's involved in another panel right now. His name is David Mateo, and he's also a string theorist. He's Spanish, so we have quite an international panel here for you today. And he works in string theory as well, and while his area is Christian. And I forgot to mention my own area. I do my PhD studying quantum chaos and how the familiar classical world and in particular chaotic phenomena can emerge from quantum mechanics. And more recently, I've been focusing on quantum computing and the theories I've worked in. So before we open the floor to start drilling our panel with whatever questions are on your mind, will you join me in some applause to welcome them? So to ask the anything idea, very formal. You can ask anything you want. You heard a little bit about what they work on, so I guess you'd be advised to ask in those areas if you want the best possible answer to this. But you can ask anything. If you want to know why the sunset is red or why the sky is blue, or you know, that's also a fair game. We should be able to do decent answers to those. You may ask us something about, for example, how to set the time in VCR. I can't guarantee you'll get a decent answer. But we'll try our best. So with that, I'll get to open the floor. Someone in the back?
Yeah, I have a question about working on the string theory. I understand that the string theory is something that's been grasped by the scientific dream in just sometime in the last few years, is that right? And it tends to contradict with an earlier theory. Am I correct there? It's no?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, it has similar goals as quantum gravity to some part, and we are kind of saying slightly different things. It's not decided what theory actually works at the end of the day.
And is that part of your goal, then, is to figure out which theory tends to rule, or are you trying to bring the different theories together?
Well, I guess it depends a little. It's a little bit politics sometimes. To some extent, people are fighting each other. To some extent, people are working together. I mean, I'm working on string theory because, well, first I went to a university where there were mainly string theorists when I started my PhD. I think it has some attractive features which quantum gravity doesn't have. On the other hand, quantum gravity probably has some other features which we don't teach. The ideal thing would be kind of to show that maybe it's the same thing or a similar thing and that we can actually work together.
Okay, well, along those lines, I find it interesting that you're working on both theories. Like, I mean, you're working on the string theory, but you have colleagues here that are working on what, in, to some people, is almost a contradictory, or where they don't.
They're competing for approaches.
Yeah,
it's obvious. Those very pleasant things.
So maybe
we can
invite
them to next week. And, you know, I mean, I don't mean that there's any arguing or anything like that, but I just think it's interesting that both theories are there. Was that actually one of the goals of setting up the institute?
Yeah, I think so. And that theme shows up again in quantum foundations, which is concerned, to some extent, concerned with different interpretations of quantum mechanics. And I think there was an effort by the Institute to have experts in different competing pictures of how to understand quantum mechanics, which are to some extent mutually exclusive. But, I mean, this is research. We don't know what the final answer is, so we want to use as many different approaches as possible. John, a question?
I would like to ask you if the strings have certain real existence, okay, rather direct existence. Mm-hmm. Or how does this link? Is it related somehow to space-time, or is there something we can observe directly? Of course, it's a very small thing.
Well, for the moment, we cannot observe it directly, but the idea would be that it's kind of similar to an electron. An electron is some point-like thing, we assume it's just a point, and the string would be, would have one dimension more. It would extend, like a rubber band, maybe. I don't know what it's made of. You could say probably some fundamental stuff. You know, it's hard to say what an electron is made of.
Well, fairly very much.
And the right one is then the properties.
Well, let's go share the questions for a moment. Yes, sir?
Yeah, so Richard Feynman says
the
last underlined part? Well, I guess the paragraph is and two pages because it's...
Well, I think I'll read two pages, but emails give you a little flavor. But,
yeah, please do.
Well, talk first about how, to really understand quantum mechanics, you need to understand the mathematics of it. And then the mathematical complexities are compounded by the fact that quantum theory is so resolutely counterintuitive. common sense is almost useless in approaching it. It's no good, Richard Feynman once said, asking why it is that way. No one knows why it is that way. That's just the way it is.
So we're basically saying that, that you have to pretty well have a PhD to figure out why, how speed of light is being calculated. And I'm like, did you read that?
Okay, you see me for a question at some point?
Yeah.
World of relativity. German scientists claim to have transmitted part of Mozart's 40th symphony of velocities by himself at the speed of light. The experiment by Jacob Mintz, the University of Cologne, especially constructed tunnel barrier. I'm not familiar with this a little bit.
Yeah,
I know. Can you explain that?
So the newspaper article referred to some experiment which purported to or seemed, I should say, send information faster than the speed of light. And one of the discoveries of Einstein, which is done for relativity, was that the speed of light was an absolute falsity, that nothing could exceed it. So some people find this puzzling, a contradiction. So actually, it turns out that what happened with this newspaper article, this experiment, is that information is not actually being transmitted faster than light. It's just that Mozart is kind of predictable. Now, you might not think that, well, you know, you couldn't write Mozart, I could write Mozart. But on very short time scales, the time, it takes only a very small fraction of a second for light to travel across this room, say. And on that time scale, Mozart, what is it, a sonata, a symphony, whatever it was, the music is not changing very much. There's a tone, and it's almost the same. And so what's happening is that there's a system that kind of extrapolates what the music is going to do next. So if it did something extremely sudden, in this small fraction of a second, surprising, that wouldn't show up on the other side. But because the music is changing only slowly, it's coming out correctly on the other side.
Here's where it really gets complicated. Right? It's physics. That's Ephraim Stein.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he says that when they started shooting lasers through the system, they couldn't figure out why it was going faster than the speed of light. So.
Is it the end of this physics article?
Well, basically, when I showed it to him, he never seen it before. He goes, well, like, you know the story of Banting and Best. He's saying that other people were claiming credit for the experiment. And, like, he said that they had done it, but they couldn't figure out why it was happening. The lasers were going faster.
Yeah. So let me read this couple sentences here.
Yeah.
At the NEC Research Institute, Princeton, New Jersey, Yi-Chun Wang took the speed of a pulse of visible light much higher than the speed of light. In fact, it was propagating through the chamber filled with objects inside the CSU depth. So that's what he's referring to. Next sentence here. Such results were not necessarily in contradiction with relativity theory, but they demanded a more careful consideration of what defines the transfer of information by light beam. So that's kind of what I was talking about. That it's really very subtle to understand what it means to send information. That in situations like the Mozart I was mentioning, you can predict kind of what's going to happen. And based on that, you might think you're getting information, but really you're not. It's just based on what you already know.
In certain sense, they're interesting, but not partly correct. If you see deeply, you also entirely, even if it's reconstructed from multiple pieces,
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen,
second
row here.
My interest is in the role of observation and the difference between in quantum mechanics, observers excluded from varying mass systems the waveform that we can description. Whereas classical system, the observers are inside. And it appears to me that there's a new terms like microscopic, and there's a very poorly understood division between what is microscopic. Because microscopic, this is false, it is normal. quantum mechanical description. It's not really microscopic. It's categorical. And yet, physicists in general don't seem to distinguish that.
What's your understanding of the term?
Well, microscopic, the term microscopic would be a quantum description. Like, say, if you had a half silver mirror experiment and you said you had two paths, well, that the two paths are microscopic. But to me, I think there's a categorical distinction between quantum mechanics and classical theory.
I would agree with you that there is some misuse of language there. I've studied the problem of how to look at quantum mechanical effects in macroscopic systems in the familiar world. And there, one has to be careful to make distinctions between talking about the size of the system and the types of physics that Adris describes. So indeed, one would expect that quantum mechanics is true all the time, whether the system is small or large. What we find, though, is that for various reasons, in part because of people's errors, and in part their inability to resolve things in fine detail in the macroscopic world, we find that classical physics is an adequate approximation when the systems are very large, and it's very coupled to the things that
are. But they're truthfully equal, because I think about pockets, the order of pressures which are given to the minds of people who are classical and I don't see how we can say one approximation, but I think it's more accurate to say that they describe a system in categories in different frames of reference.
Well, I figure out a second, but you want to take that? I think under certain conditions you find that they both theories will work very well. Both theories are mathematical theories. And certain objects in the mathematical formalism relate to things we can observe in the lab or in everyday life. And under certain conditions we find that both theories work very well. But we know for sure that for systems like atoms, which are microscopic or submicroscopic, and a wide variety of materials that are very cold, the classical mechanics fails to describe them correctly. And the general assumption, which is an area of active research to some extent, is to understand, is to confirm by the assumption made by most physicists, which is that quantum mechanics never fails, that it can be applied, the mathematics of quantum mechanics can be applied to describe everything we see, barring maybe some general relativity effects. But barring general relativity, that's what's a problem with these guys who are down at the end here, I'm also on my right. The idea is that for electromagnetism and the other forces, mainly electromagnetism, that quantum mechanics is adequate no matter what the size of the system. But it should be correct. Only classical mechanics is only correct for some of the time.
So, actually, I guess something to add to that, which is there are some people who study what's called the mesoscopic systems, which are systems of maybe a few hundred or a few thousand atoms. And frequently they find these systems behave in a way that's kind of in between quantum mechanical and classical. They've done very short times, they'll behave quantum mechanically. But on long times, as interactions with surrounding systems start to become important, it behaves much more classically.
Like, for example, two photons would normally be classical systems. They have separate properties.
No, actually if they're individual photons, then they're going to behave quantum mechanically.
But two would be classical systems. And yet, using a mechanism, the aspect is
perfect.
So you can.
The fact that they're separate doesn't prevent them from behaving quantum mechanically. That's one of the interesting facts.
Let me point you to something else, which is Anton Zeilinger, who actually be here first week of March giving a public lecture. And he's been pursuing an experimental program of demonstrating quantum effects. Increasingly large systems, very large buckyballs, which have about 60 or 70 atoms, depending on which ones you use, and demonstrating you see quantum mechanical effects in these systems. And he's really pushing the limit of exploring the validity of quantum mechanics as you go to increasingly large scale systems. So maybe you can look into that further. But let's move along and take another question. The gentleman in the back.
This might be a sort of a wide, loose of a question for anyone. If I wanted to build a time machine, like, is there any way I can go about doing that? Is there anything? Well, how would you guys do it? You guys would have to
answer that question.
First of all, very expensive. Because you pay money up front. Okay. Yeah, because basically, if you have a lot of government, if the funding, so you fund time machine,
yeah,
into building research into some exotic, and I mean, exotic, absolutely good matter, whose properties are absolutely contradictory and absolutely variant with all types of any matter we have here. Provided we have such matter, using it, we can build, using it and assuming that we can keep it stable, we can build things which are called warp pods. And they can be used either for faster than light travel or working in pairs for going back in time. Then, of course, there is a lot of interesting and contradictory theories about how exactly it happens and what you can and what you cannot do when you go back in time, whether you can kill your grandfather or you cannot. But the first step, as far as we understand now, the first necessary step in building anything that resembles time machine is to get a huge supply of very good matter. And under normal conditions, this matter is supposed not to work.
What's it called?
It's just a matter that anything that will violate certain standard conditions on mass energy and relation between energy and pressure, for example. Something like if I can turn into something with negative mass or negative energy, then it will be very helpful in this project.
I'm sure I'm going to hold your breath. Does anybody have a question about either quantum gravity or string theory? So if you get a chance, or get, sir.
When I was little, atoms or electrons, little balls circling around the atom, I was quite happy with that. And gravity fields were like magnetic fields that sort of pulled us toward it. Then when I got older, they said, no, the truth really is that electrons are sort of a fuzzy wave, and they can collapse from one state to the other without going through any in-between state. And I kind of tried to wrap my head around that. And they also said gravity is actually more like a bending space-time, like that little funnel that you put the penny in and it goes around. Now we're starting to talk about quantum gravity. My head starts to do this. Can the Earth jump from one position to another position without going through any in-between state? Tell me I'm wrong, Adam.
Very, very improbable. I mean, basically, in quantum gravity, you have, like, I mean, the whole space becomes quantum, so it's kind of fuzzy and hard for, like, wave patterns, something like that. But it happens on very, very small scale. As soon as you get a big system, the effects of quantum gravity disappear and fade off, and everything world is classical. So if you want to have some effects of quantum gravity on a large scale, you have to look at very large systems.
So if we jump from one state to another, we'd be so small we won't notice?
Yes.
Okay.
And basically you can stop worrying about it if you don't worry about all the molecules in the air, in this room suddenly going to one corner and all but suffocating, then the probability of significant jump by all estimates is much, much, much lower than of this tragic event. So we are pretty safe.
It's going to take a little while. Moving fast.
I'm just wondering to what extent our ability to understand mathematics affects our ability to predict this. For example, not Clea calculus, which is great, and I like calculus, but what if calculus is just one way of putting numbers together and predicting things? But what if there's another way that's more complex that works slightly differently in calculus? If you're using all those mathematical equations to predict things in physics, to what extent is that affecting your ability to come up with answers to physics?
My favorite answer is, I'd like to have an answer to this question. I ask myself all the time whether what we're doing is the only way. So we just try to push theory to extremes, to make as many predictions as we can, and see what happens. And just wait for things to break down. And then probably there will be a hint how to do things differently, but I'm sure that my solution will be different sets of units.
You probably need a few answers
instead. Yeah, sure.
actually in people, and there's quite a few of these who get to a point where they're not satisfied with the mathematics that we use to describe quantum mechanics or when we work with quantum gravity. So they're trying to develop new mathematics, but change the process. And as there's just a few people working on that, like trying to reformulate quantum mechanics and new ways of describing geometry in space-time, it takes a while to try to understand these mathematical tools while they are not in demo.
So I'd also add that frequently there's mathematically more than one way to describe systems. So you can use different types of mathematics. But then at the end, when you do this calculation, you can do it totally different ways. So you should always get the same answer in all of these different ways. Otherwise, one of them is right and one of them is wrong. And that's kind of the limit of theory. We're a theoretical systems too. So we just kind of think about these things through the math. But ultimately, somebody has to go into a lab, do an experiment, and test which one of these, if they're different, answers, which one of them is right. Maybe none of them is right.
Yeah, I have a slightly different perspective on this question, which is you asked about the relationship between mathematical description and predictability. And that's something I slightly put it in, which is pertaining to chaos theory. And there we have a problem where we know the laws of physics for describing a certain situation, so we can write down an equation to describe the forces and constraints that control the behavior. But under certain conditions, we can't actually identify a simple mathematical solution that will allow us to predict how that system behaves. And the most kind of paradigmatic example of that are the chaotic systems, where there's some intrinsic instability in the system, such that even though we can describe the system mathematically, we have the correct theory, our very small imprecision in our knowledge of the system grows very rapidly. And so we lose our ability to predict how the system will behave on an extremely short time scale. And there's this famous quote of, you know, butterflies and plastic wings in Japan called the Earth and the Texas or something along those lines. And that's an example of this. That's an example of this type of erratic sensitivity to small changes. And those systems are systems where you can't write down simple mathematical solutions to describe the behavior.
So maybe since you got an answer from everybody, it's also quoted by, it's from Einstein. He said that the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. And I think he meant that it can be described mathematically. So indeed, I think there's something very deep about the fact that you can use mathematics to describe the physical world.
Another broad question. I've been hearing a lot about nanotechnology. Don't quite get it. And secondly, does things like string theory have an impact on nanotechnology? They may be disjointed, but maybe you can fill in some gaps from there.
Sure. So I think string theory is nanotechnology because it's a theory that would make, as we understand it now, at least for most people, will make an impact or it has implications at the very, very, very tiny scales. Much, much more than any nanotechnology we can grow today. I don't know if that answers your question.
On the broader topic, just of nanotechnology and the impact.
Sure. So regular nanotechnology, with only one nano, is dealing with building things out of single atoms. Maybe little machines like a little motor out of small numbers of atoms, or things that would manipulate chemicals in various ways, for instance. And that has a very close relation to what I work on, quantum computing. Because quantum computing is using single atoms to build computers, so nanotechnology would certainly help in building a quantum computer. And conversely, a quantum computer would be very good for designing nanotechnological devices. So it does have a relationship to stuff you work on here.
Quantum computers. A month or two ago, there was a special issue of Scientific American titled Beyond Einstein. And in there, one of the articles referred to of quantum computers using memory, where instead of a single electron, it was using the spin of electrons to simulate a bit. the diagrams someone showed there, that there are 16 positions of the spin of the electron. Now, I take it that is the positions was the polarity moving, the poles of the electron, if you will.
Yeah.
I showed 16, which gets you into hexadecimal, etc. Is that a completely variable thing, or is there the possibility of detecting 64 rather than 16 positions? I don't understand the spin of electrons.
So, spin is kind of a mysterious quantity. We can imagine large objects that spin, but subatomic particles like electrons have something called intrinsic spin, which is related somehow to regular spinning, but it's not exactly the same. So it is kind of mysterious. But actually, there's not just 16 or 64, there's an infinite number of possible directions that a single spin could go. But the properties of quantum mechanics say that you can never see more than two alternatives. So you say, I want to measure whether the spin is pointing up or pointing down. And you get an answer to that question. It'll be up or down. It's binary, but it's not binary. It's quantum mechanical. So this is one of those examples where quantum mechanics is intuitive.
If you find this, you're just happy.
Yeah. And it gets even more confusing if you have two electrons. Because, you could look at them and say they're both up or they're both down. But in some sense, they can be both at once. And that's what's called an entangled quantum state. And that has these weird properties that we were mentioning before. You could move these electrons very far apart, and they still behave quantum mechanically. They have a very special correlation that couldn't be made with any kind of classical object. So, yes, it's confusing. I know I didn't really answer the question, but...
Yes.
But basically, you pointed to one of the main difficulties of quantum mechanics. Because on one hand, yes, we have all these possible directions. And this is all polymeric. So powerful, we can, in a certain sense, in one shot, make all possible calculations, and out of all wrong answers, you get also one right answer. The problem is that we can measure only some binary answers. So just by doing the right sort of calculation, and then shooting a random answer, we're likely to get nothing. And this is why all the sophisticated techniques are necessary. And this is why the progress in developing quantum algorithms for quantum computing is so painful and so slow.
Thank you, Mr. Carlos. Do we have any questions from the young people? We haven't heard any questions. Anything they're curious about?
If you make the ball spin, it's just turn around on itself, because of the air it's around, it's just going, just like if you were taking a ball and making it turn on some flat surface on the table, it's just going to move forward. So just the same with the air, because it turns, it's just going to take like press speed on the air around it, and just move. So if you turn this way on the air, the ball will just move this way.
Maybe
it's a big time to use the blackboard. This also applies to
baseball
fans as well. Yeah, and ball.
So if you have your soccer ball and it's turning, say, this way, then the air is moving this way. Okay? So the air is kind of coming this way relative to it. See, and the air on this side sees the ball moving faster because it's, this side of the ball is going up, as well as the direction of the ball, the movement of the ball. Whereas on this side, that's right. This side's a little slower because this side is moving back. At the same time, the whole ball is moving forward. And so the air on different sides sees different kind of motion, and it pushes differently.
Well, depends on the situation.
Depends on the problem.
The
pressure on the
audience
as well.
That is.
But, isn't it an interesting novel way of thinking of it to expand one of us? For example, what the reality of our classroom space changes from spin to consistent? That would be a limitation. But if in fact, the quantum mechanical space has a different orthos from safety, a spin 180 is actually an equivalent to a spin 360 in classical space, then basically you're talking about different dimensional frameworks, simpler dimensional frameworks. So in fact, a particular dimensional piece is completed at classical level, cross-connect level, complete. So basically, you should think of classical framework and quantum framework just as different dimensional frameworks.
I'm just wondering if you think that's how it's like. And there's a way of describing kind of geometry that encapsulates these spin one half particles.
Okay. And then the second row, is it possible to create perpetual motion using remnants? Okay, so take that.
Unless again, you can invent some book.
Well, let's just elaborate on this more generally. There's no way to create perpetual motion in any way. That it's just one of those fundamental laws of physics that whenever you try to get work out of some machine, you're going to be wasting some energy too. So it'll always run down.
Okay, so we have heard from before.
How is the uniform theory of everything? Are there any developments in it with respect to your AX/16 or that one working on it? Or is it always going to be a thing for help?
Too many competing ideas on that kind of stuff. Which you agree on your, or all three of you maybe want to the past few months you felt.
I think in the introduction I already explained that string theory is actually trying to explain the incorporate all the physical laws. It's an approach. It's not yet 100% successful because we haven't been able to reproduce everything. But we have good toys, and it's in a sense close to nature, but it's just a toy. And the hope is that we actually get better at modifying string theory a little bit and getting a little bit out of it.
Yeah, I can say that's one way to think about string theory is that theory under continuous construction. So we don't really have a fully satisfactory mathematical first principle formulation theory. But nevertheless, I mean, there have been a lot of progress in the last 10 years, and I just think one, for example, we have been able to give an explanation for the entropy, a microscopic quantum of the degree of freedom in a black hole, in a black hole. And that's a huge theoretical achievement.
For all kinds of black holes?
No, for certain black holes. So the challenge remains to explain, to do the same thing for four-dimensional ordinary black holes. But that's already a big step.
So that's a quantum gravity expert take a stab at that? Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in the theory of everything. I believe it's impossible that we can be impossible. A lot of times people, when they hear about quantum gravity, they think, they try to explain the structure of space under a small scale, so they explain almost everything. But it's much less complicated than that, just trying to describe how space works. And it might explain a lot of things, but all the philosophical implicit notions when people talk about the theory of everything, I think it's just a dream.
And it's the intersection of complicated philosophy and religion and all that.
Well, thank you for your question. We move on to the next question. Oh, the other man is walking.
Einstein said that nothing could go faster than the speed of light, but then wouldn't, if a black hole has been vaporizing faster than that, wouldn't its own gravity be prevented from escaping? And so it would kind of just pop off into a different universe or something?
That's a very interesting question.
Short answer, maybe. if it's more complicated answer, there are funny theories, again, equations which use Einstein equations of gravity, that have some mathematical solutions. It's a bit of fantasy and a thing for philosophical generalization. You can interpret a different universe. Now, one of the popular, what is the problem? One of the interesting problems, and probably you've heard a lot of noise about it, is what happens with information and when black hole evaporates. And there have been a lot of proposals to explain it or to explain it away. One of such proposals was actually built on a very typical theory that when there is actual collapse, when it collapses with the black hole, then deep inside it, what we call singularity, and think, okay, all our things just stop working there. So the singularity is, in a certain sense, an entrance to the new universe, called the same universe. Now, yes, mathematical solution. We can give it nice interpretations. We cannot be sure. And moreover, this solution is derived under interesting and sometimes associated assumptions. Many of them are done just in case we're able to solve something. So there are a lot of question marks. It's one beautiful and attractive alternative, but so we are very far from being able to go down there and check. But that's an option.
So maybe I can give a slightly different answer to the question. Again, you have to be kind of careful what it means for something to travel faster than the speed of light, or travel at all. So if you have kind of a black hole, if that matter, a star or a planet that's just been kind of in the same place for a long time, its gravitational field is already developed and it's just kind of sitting there. It's not really going anywhere. So it doesn't really matter what the escape velocity of this black hole is. Because its gravitational field is already established. It was established when the black hole first collapsed. And so then it's kind of stopped there. It can't go. On the other hand, there are gravitational effects where you have to worry about the speed of light. And so, for instance, if you somehow could take this black hole and shake it, you could emit something called gravitational radiation, which is kind of like gravity, but also kind of like light. And that could travel through space, but it can only do it at the speed of light.
That's a good question. The gentleman over here.
This is sort of a simple string question. It's one of the things that made Einstein, sort of accessible to the masses was that he came up with something that could put out a t-shirt, right? E equals mc squared. Everybody can kind of get a handle on that. Is there going to be anything like that out of string theory? And also, like, right? I mean, it's such a nebulous idea for most people, and I'm worried that when you guys have your big day and everything's done and you got your solution, that it's going to be just incomprehensible. And also, I'm wondering if you can tell me what practical application of it might be once you've got it here.
But I would know something that you could scribble on a t-shirt.
You know what I mean?
Not an equation, but you can scribble the Kant's diagram, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. If you could scribble something like that, maybe. So that's kind of supposed to be... Well, that's kind of like a donut with four arms there. That's about the strings coming in and strings coming out. So that would be kind of what E equals mc squared, or t squared, right?
So it's a t squared from a lot of it.
We know what it means, right? Like something that...
Some central...
No, maybe it's like, okay, I can at least pretend to understand what that means, and see some significance.
True, it's good to say that one can pretend to understand what it means. We can say, when one is to a talk by Warner Isra, he was talking about what I mentioned before, the macroscopic usurping of black holes. And he wrote down this equation. This tells you that if you know the area of the black hole, then you know how many degrees of freedom there are in the black hole. And he said, this is to the physicists, in particular to the physicists, like what E equals mc squared is for the general public. Everybody writes it down and nobody understands it. So maybe we should put that in the t-shirt.
So what's a practical... What's going to be a practical application of this, or something that...
One application would be, so you could ask, why do you need string theory? Why do you need a theory that incorporates all four forces together in a unified manner to system quantum mechanics? One place is to understand black holes, and another one would be to understand the very beginning of the universe, for example. At that point, all effects that come into the game are too strong to ignore quantum mechanics or general relativity or the rest of the forces. So you need a unified field to understand that. So that would be a big achievement.
Thank you, thanks.
I have a question, but I think it's a little bit more true. When it's a cloudy day, you have a light, you usually would care what the message is alive. If you light in this particle,
that might be successive summits.
Yeah.
Always see the light first.
My guess would be that...
You mean
No, it's certainly not that. So my guess would be actually that in that case the lightning is so far away, frequently you may not be able to see the lightning because it's so here, because there's something in the way that's blocking the light. But the thunder can still get through. That'd be my guess.
So it's two successive strikes again.
I'm assuming that. Why the moon when it's floating here on Egypt and going to South
Africa? We need to count up on that one.
So this is the question, which is that it's an optical illusion. I mean, it's the human visual system has a lot of tricks for understanding what it's seeing around it. Turns out it's very hard to make a computer see things and understand what they are, see this is a chair and it's a person. And so our eyes and our brain are pretty good at interpreting things, but sometimes we get it wrong. And something about, I'm not sure exactly, it's not at all my field, but something about the presence of trees or buildings or stuff here at the horizon can make the moon look big, but it's not really big.
Is there anybody we haven't heard from before? This gentleman from
50 years ago when I went to university, atomic theory was just that, a theory of atoms. Nobody had ever seen one. 50 years later, has anyone ever seen an atom? And if not, more than ever possible to see an atom as all six of atomic particles.
Well, we have lifestyle astrophy now that you can see actually the surfaces of this IBM sketch. It's a motto in atoms, and you can actually distinguish the shape of the width of some number of atoms, so 2 or 3, or maybe can you remember all that?
You can see, I think we can see single atoms. Maybe not
that particular thing. Usually the electrons get
designed to like how long does that take? How long does that take?
20 years?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With the scanning electron microscope.
Scanning the electron microscopy been around decades. Again, just recently it's become much more sophisticated and much cheaper. Like, in olden days you didn't bring about having scanned their scanning electron microscope in the usual university lab. Now it's quite a common device. Okay, not as common as a kettle, which is a necessary percentage of progress, but it's not something outlandish.
And of course, Rutherford did experiments, I guess,
90 years ago showing that the atomic structure was what we now understand to be, namely some type of nuclear core and electron cloud around it, which replaced quantum physics for having some proton goo in the whole atom.
Also, just the accelerators, not just microscopes. They don't work with normal light.
But the point is that there is a gap, as always. And the gap is that you don't really see that. You see something, that something else, down to something else, as opposed to a long chain of things hitting each other, actually, supposed by understanding which way, in what way they interact, that finally leads to emotional light. So it's a long chain of application and interaction, and if you wish, maybe you will graph people interesting interpretations or questions, or some people who work in foundation for quantum mechanics. Quite easily ask, does this, what I see is not an electron. I see the light emitted by something that was properly hit by electrons. Okay, it's light, that's not as much my chain of interpretation. And okay, it's an interpretation system that they work, but this is the only thing that I can say about the reality of the system that they can see.
Okay, who haven't we heard from yet to have a question?
I'm just wondering if any progress has been made in understanding dark energy or dark matter any more than what it was 50 years ago.
Why is it 90 some odd percent?
Yeah, that's a great question. John, I just wonder if there's anything like in the last few years that came in
Could be the part of it. So at least experimentally, I don't think 50 years ago we used so well that actually the dark energy.
Yeah, 50 years ago I'm not even sure we did dark matter.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, but it's only been in recent years that very good astronomical measurements
have shown
reasonable doubt that there is a positive structure.
Okay,
we still have no idea what
it is.
So
does that call into question the whole theory of the Big Bang? Or not saying
yes.
We can understand the theory of the Big Bang, but it can be changed.
So we have to be careful about what we mean by the Big Bang. The Big Bang, I think in its most basic form, just means that at one time, matter in the universe was much, much denser than it is today, where we have stars and a lot of space in between, and much hotter. And that's not at all about. But the details of how it got that way and how it's behaved since then are.
Okay, I promise a short question to my enthusiastic first row audience.
Okay. Hawking's said at the end of the quote, and then we will know the mind is God. Okay, so I'm a big Sagan fan. And Sagan was organizing, all these UFO conventions, except he's getting the best people in there. So what I want to know is, your opinion of all of you, do you think there is a supreme intelligence out there? Somebody that's smarter than all of us together?
Very personal question.
I can venture a statistical observation. I'll hope you of different traditions I've seen and met personally. The highest concentration of religious observant people was among cosmologists and people that work in gravity. I mean, big questions of light, universe, and all that. It's just a statistic. Probably the flawed statistic was just based on my observations, but still, this is something that I used to wonder about.
Can I ask you something?
Does anybody else want to answer that dragon question at all? Anybody else want to answer that question? Okay.
Sorry. People are engineers. And some people, the brains,
where I'm faster than others, but I'm slower and faster. That means there are limited qualities to God. I think that's even the spiritual thing, and then by having higher things.
Okay, we're basically out of time. Somebody has a very short question. Just one more very short question. Okay, go.
Given that a lot of the significant developments in science through the centuries have been made by individuals sort of working alone and doing, you know, carrots and things, you know, albeit with the knowledge of the previous things that came before them, what are the panelists' perceptions of working together and collective in the Premier Institute? Is it just sort of wallowing, you know, amongst yourselves in the ivory tower, or do you think it is beneficial to advancing, you know, the physics and the various specialties? Just a smaller sub-question. I have to note that there are no female members of the panel, and are there any female members in the institute, or is that just sort of
all right, you've called us on something. I tried to find a female member, but we have several women up in our institute. We have one long-term researcher, and I think we have three postdocs out of 14. And so
it's there are women, but it's a small percentage.
And then let me just question. Yeah.
Let me just wrap up by answering this question.
We can all found the ability to work with other people here has been a big advantage to all of our research. To making advances now towards a great deal of specialization and understanding a lot of previous research. And it is very helpful to people around who provide a resource you can bounce questions off of and solve problems together. And we've all participated in that and enjoyed it quite a bit. So thank you for your attention and your wonderful questions.